Hey, as always, thank you for inviting me into your home. My name is Richard Serrett. Welcome to Coast AM. We're broadcasting live from Coast's affiliate in Toronto, Canada. Talk radio AM 640 on the shores of Lake Ontario. Literally, just around the corner of the building facing south onto Lake Ontario. Just before the show, I stepped out there and caught a glimpse. Not a glimpse. I stared for quite a while at this. Well, it's tomorrow night we'll get the full show. But tonight, it's emerging as the second supermoon this summer. And the moonbeams, my Lord, they were just sparkling like diamonds on the rippling waters of Lake Ontario. And there were some nice cruise boats drifting by in the moonlight. It was just spectacular. And it's only going to get better tomorrow, because tomorrow night is the full supermoon. A supermoon is, if you're not aware, it's kind of a coincidental, you've got the full moon, which is a sight to behold all on its own, right? But then you've got a full moon combined with the closest approach the moon makes to the Earth during its rather elliptical orbit. And it just results in this, well, it's the biggest full moon you can ever imagine. It's just unbelievable, just splendiferous. And it's about 14%. A supermoon is about 14% bigger than a regular full moon and 30% brighter. It's quite a show, folks, so get out and enjoy it. I have sisters who are nurses, and I know many of you know where I'm headed with this. Emergency responders will tell you that during a regular full moon, never mind a supermoon, during a regular full moon, they are working overtime, ER rooms, police. The crime stats bear this out. They receive more calls during a full moon. And I'd like to see some statistics from police and hospital ERs during a supermoon. And there will be another supermoon coming down the pipe next month, September the 9th. So to have them, to have three in such close proximity, we had one in July, now one tonight, tomorrow night, and then September. It's very rare. And in fact, we won't have another sort of cluster of supermoons like this until the year 2034. I'll tell you something. My sleep is affected by the lunar cycle. And during a supermoon, I do not sleep. I swear to God, I do not sleep during a supermoon. I toss and I turn. So anyway, I'm going to be up all night anyway. So what better way to spend the night than here with you on Coast to Coast AM? Coming up in hours 2, 3, and 4 of the program, aside from the supermoon, there's something else noteworthy on the horizon in August. In just several days, in fact, August the 15th will mark the, wait for it, 45th anniversary of the Woodstock Music and Arts Fair of Woodstock, or the Woodstock Music Festival, as it's known, billed as an Aquarian Exposition, 3 days of peace and music. Of course, held at Max Yasger's 600-acre dairy farm in the Catskills. Not actually in Woodstock, but closer to the town of Bethel, New York, August 15th to the 18th, 1969. And during that sometimes rainy weekend, there were 32 acts that performed outdoors before an audience of about 400,000. Widely regarded as a pivotal moment in popular music history. In fact, Rolling Stone magazine listed it as one of the 50 moments that changed the history of rock and roll. But of course, there were other free music festivals during the turbulent 60s, and we're going to talk about some of the artists that made their bones during those festivals and talk about what really happened to the likes of Otis Redding, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Mama Cass Elliott, rock and roll investigator R. Gary Patterson will be my guest with more tales from the rock and roll graveyard. And towards the tail end of the program, you know, Gary always brings a special mystery guest with him. And tonight, towards the tail end, a gentleman who is going to talk about another iconic rock and roll figure. And this gentleman didn't appear at Monterey or Woodstock or Altamont, but he does loom large in the pantheon of the rock counterculture. I'm talking about John Lennon. And our mystery guest knew John before the Beatles. He knew John before the Quarrymen. That tells you how far back he goes. Looking forward to our Gary Patterson and his mystery guest as we talk about the counterculture of rock, Woodstock, Altamont, the Monterey Pop Festival. Many of you, and I know there are many of you, who are huge fans of The Twilight Zone, as am I. But one of my favorite episodes just aired up here on a cable channel a couple of weeks ago. It was The Night Call. Do you remember that? It's from, oh gosh, I think it's about season 5. So we're talking about 1964. And there's this elderly disabled woman played by Gladys Cooper, who I believe appeared in a number of Twilight episodes. Anyway, in this episode, she starts receiving these haunting late night telephone calls from a stranger. It's in the middle of a stormy night. And during the first calls, all she hears on the other end is static. Later, she hears a man moaning, and she repeatedly demands to know who's calling. Finally, he says, "Hello, where are you? I want to talk to you." And Gladys Cooper's character, Elva, of course, is terrified, and she screams at the man to leave her alone. The phone company in the episode traces the cause to a telephone line that has fallen in a cemetery. So Elva and her housekeeper, they visit the cemetery where she finds the telephone line, you guessed it, resting on the grave of her long-deceased fiancé, Brian Douglas. Now, Elva has left the building. Elva says that she's always insisted in having her own way, and her fiancé, the late Brian, always did what she said. So a week before they were to be married, she insisted on driving. She lost control of the car. The accident kills Brian and cripples her. So now that she can talk to him again, she won't have to be alone. At home, she picks up the phone. She calls out to Brian, pleading with him to answer. He replies, she told him to leave her alone, and that's what he's going to do. The line goes dead. Elva is alone, crying in her bed. According to the Bible, God created the heavens and the earth, Rod Serling says at the end. It's a man's prerogative and a woman's to create their own particular and private hell. Case in point, Miss Elva Keen, who in every sense has made her own bed and now must lie in it, sadder but wiser, by dint of a rather painful lesson in responsibility transmitted from the Twilight Zone. Do you remember that? Over the years, I've talked to several dozen people on the radio, and they sincerely, genuinely believe they've received a similar type of phone call, a telephone call from the dead. Now I'm hearing wind that there have been, over the last dozen years, a series of somewhat scientific studies conducted on this very topic, just a couple of hours down the 401, the Highway 401 from where I'm sitting, at Western University in London, by a Dr. Imanse Barous, who's conducted, as I say, several studies attempting to verify reports that deceased persons have communicated to the living through electronic devices. When we come back here on Coast to Coast, I'm going to speak with a reporter with the Epoch Times who's been all over this study on telephone calls from the dead. And we'll find out whether it's plausible that some dark and stormy night, just like Elva Keen from The Twilight Zone, some of us might pick up the phone and hear a faint voice from the other side asking if we'll reverse the charges. My name is Richard Wavy Gravy Sarrett. And what I have in mind is breakfast in bed for $500,000. This is Coast to Coast AM. Coast, Richard Serrett with you. And we were speaking with Tara McIsaac, who is a Beyond Science reporter for Epoch Times. She explores the new frontiers of science, delving into ideas that could help uncover the mysteries of our wondrous world. Tara McIsaac, welcome to Coast AM.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure, and I'm fascinated by your beat. You're one of the few print journalists that are covering the paranormal in this sense. How did you first get started writing about things like telephone calls from the dead and reincarnation and all the things that you cover for Epoch Times?
Yeah, I mean, I feel very fortunate to be able to, you know, read and write things that I find fascinating for a living. And yeah, the Epoch Times is open to exploring, you know, ideas like reincarnation or, you know, a lot of these phenomena that there are actually, you know, some scientific studies out there on them. And, you know, I get to look into those studies and see, you know, what the scientists are saying about them and just take a look at them. So that's kind of the concept behind Beyond Science. It's what we'd call, you know, looking at the frontier of science and things that, you know, science hasn't been able to quite grasp yet, but it's sort of getting there. And we're trying to look at, you know, scientists who are helping it get there.
Well, kudos to you and Epoch Times, because I think people are so hungry for this kind of information. And yet, by and large, the mainstream media tends to give it a wide berth. You know, they don't want to talk about these things. And yet this is a regular column for you. First of all, did you come at this subject with any personal bias? Do you happen to believe in spirit communication, or did you come at it with absolutely no opinion whatsoever?
Personally, I am a spiritual person, but, you know, I guess the way that I approach it is I want to sort of bridge the gap a little bit and just look at it objectively, you know, look at the studies that are there. There's a, you know, there might be a phenomenon that I'm looking at and my mind's open to the possibility that it is what it is. You know, it is what people say it is. And, but I'd rather just look at, you know, what the studies say about it and just look at the facts. And, you know, I guess, I think that keeping an open mind about it is good. And I admit to the possibility, but, you know, I think that among these phenomena, there could be genuine examples. There could also be some that aren't genuine. So I try to keep a balanced head, I guess.
Well, let's talk about this, a series really going back, almost 13 years, a series of scientific experiments at Western Ontario University in London, which is down the road a couple hours from where I'm sitting. Dr. Imance Barous, take me back, I guess, to about 2001 and just give us a thumbnail sketch of what these experiments involving purported phone calls from the dead, what these experiments involved, what he was trying to accomplish, and what the findings were.
Yeah, Dr. Barous, you know, had looked into previous research on this phenomenon, and he found that a lot of it was, you know, called into question for maybe faulty process and this kind of thing. So he wanted to do a real serious study. And basically, the way he set it up, he went and talked to some of the previous researchers and got some advice. And one of the pieces of advice he got was the only way it's going to succeed is if you have a spiritual purpose. And another piece of advice he got was that you have to, quote, establish a contact field through regular and persistent effort, end quote. So he basically tried to set up an experiment that would try and meet those requirements while still, you know, following the process that needs to be followed in a scientific experiment. So he gained some research assistants who he felt had high integrity, which, you know, could, to all extents and purposes, you know, meet the requirement of a spiritual purpose as much as possible. And he set up a recorder in a quiet room on campus at Western. And basically with these experiments, what you do is you tune to a radio station between stations. So you tune the radio between stations, so you've got sort of that static there. And basically you record. And so the assistants took turns sitting in this room and sort of asking questions to any spirits that might be in the room who might be trying to communicate. And he totaled 60 hours of recording, and basically they listened to it after to see if they could hear, you know, any anomalies in the recording. And they heard a lot of static and dramatic fluctuations, which previous researchers would say was a spirit trying to get through. And they did find some, you know, some interesting words that they could pick out that he felt basically in the end that he had replicated the previous research in a weak sense, but not in a strong one. He didn't feel that he had absolute proof or anything that was completely convincing, but he raised some really interesting questions about the whole process at the end of it.
I think the title of the first study, which was in fact published in the Journal of Scientific Exploration, as you point out in your article on the Epoch Times, the title was Failure to Replicate Electronic Voice Phenomena, but it admits partial success in replication. So, I mean, what are we to take away what does that mean scientifically if someone says partial success? I mean, does that then suggest that it's plausible, that it's possible that spirits from the other side are able to somehow manipulate electronics in some way in order to communicate with us?
Yeah, I guess what I came away from it with was that it is possible. I mean, with something like this, it's so hard to get a 100%, this is for sure, this is what's happening kind of thing. But the study was really, really open to that possibility. And, for example, one of the interesting things that happened was they heard the words, tell Peter. And both Baruch and his assistants heard this independently. And the assistant who was in the room at the time thought that the voice sounded like a deceased woman she knows whose husband was named Peter. And so, Dr. Baruch is open to the idea, it seems, that, some of these strange occurrences did happen during this time. But I guess, he set out what he would require for it to be replicated in the strong sense. And, for example, one of the requirements, he said, if one of the voices clearly came through and talked to the research assistant and said things that only that research assistant could possibly know, that would be considered a strong replication. That would be a success. So, he didn't meet those kinds of requirements, but he was able to replicate what people in the past had said that they heard. So he felt that it was worthwhile enough to continue his efforts and look at possible weaknesses in his own study, including, the idea that, there might not have been a sufficient enough spiritual purpose. And, he really listened to a lot of the researchers from the past who may not have had their work published in scientific journals, but who, I guess brought together this wealth of experience and felt that there were certain requirements that would lead to a successful experience of this phenomena. So he came back to the drawing table and tweaked his experiments and tried it again several years later.
And I believe there was another set of experiments conducted around 2007 and then 2011. So what is the latest? Bring us up to date on Dr. Baruch's experiments.
Yeah, the recent ones that he published were basically, he tweaked it a little bit. He brought in a medium because, in the past, some people have said that you need somebody who's a medium to be there to, maybe establish that contact field that was talked about before. And he also, to eliminate the sort of vague sounding, the static between radio stations, some people say that when this phenomena occurs, it's people just hearing words where there aren't any. They're just sort of forming the static into words that they want to hear. And in fact, a lot of the previous researchers said that, you have to spend months trying this and listening to it to be able to develop sort of an ear for it. So to eliminate that confusion, he decided to establish computer programs that would randomly generate letters and words. And this way, it's clearly on the screen. And, he analyzed the words that were generated to see if they made phrases that made any sense or that would be considered anomalous. And he also had this random event generator that would generate either yes or no, the two answers. So he would ask questions and see, what the response was. And again, with the random word generator, he did get sort of this weak replication where there were certain phrases that seemed like you could interpret them as a spirit trying to communicate. For example, they asked, what do we need to know that we don't understand about this? And immediately they heard the word opportunity, Oh, sorry, I didn't mention that they also had sound bites being played. Basically, they had this program that would cut sound bites and randomly paste them back together out of order to make different phrases, the audio there. So basically, they heard the word opportunity, and then the random word generator also made a phrase that had the word opportunity in it. So, you know, there was another one where the word continue was repeated again and again.
Okay, I've got the, let me just jump in here, Tara. The music's coming up. We're going to step away here. We'll come back and we'll continue to delve into these experiments at the University of Western Ontario. Telephone calls from the dead, a fascinating study. Tara McIsaac from the Epoch Times here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. And welcome back, Jerry Garcia, The Grateful Dead. Uncle John's band, Rolling Stone Magazine, had a special commemorative issue dedicated to the late Jerry Garcia, who passed nearly 20 years ago, 1995, I guess it was. Of course, the front man from one of the great bands that performed at Woodstock, and we will be talking about the 45th anniversary of Woodstock with rock and roll investigator R. Gary Patterson a little bit later. Rolling Stone magazine said Uncle John's band is his greatest, Jerry Garcia's greatest, the Grateful Dead's greatest song. I don't know if you concur, but I certainly would have to put it right up there. Richard Serrett with you. You can hear me on The Conspiracy Show up here in Canada on AM 740 Zoomer Radio. RichardSerrett.com, the website, and just a quick plug for the TV show. Our season 3 of The Conspiracy Show on television debuts across Canada on Vision TV Monday night, August 11th at 10 p.m. Eastern. All right, we are talking about telephone calls from the dead, and not just anecdotal evidence. It may surprise you to know that at the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario, there have been a number of fairly rigorous scientific studies on this phenomenon. And there have been, you know, many experiments carried out over the years with varying degrees of success. But it's rare that the mainstream modern scientific literature would weigh in on something like this. Often experiments are dismissed by some as flawed in their process or as failing to yield the degree of certainty required by mainstream science to accept the phenomenon as real as the results that Dr. Imance Barouche has come up with. And we are talking with Tara McIsaac, a Beyond Science reporter with the Epoch Times. And we'll get back to more of that conversation when Coast to Coast continues right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM. We are with Tara McIsaac from the Epoch Times, and she has written a series of articles regarding a fascinating study of purported phone calls from the dead, experiments conducted at the University of Western Ontario. And Tara, let's just discuss for a few moments before we take some phone calls, discuss for a few moments the apparatus involved here. You've been describing what sounds an awful lot like what we call Frank's box, a device which scans in between these radio stations. And as you say, we get that sort of that staticky white noise, but it picks up the odd word maybe from one station to the next, and it seems to form sentences. Is that what we're discussing here, Frank's box, or was this especially designed for the experiment?
I'm not exactly sure. I think that it was, I got the impression that it was just sort of a radio tuned between stations, and they were recording that. So, yeah, the idea is that sort of the static between stations provides sort of a medium for, you know, any spirits that might want to communicate to come through.
And the idea is that if there are these spirits on the other side, they're somehow able to manipulate the electromagnetic field in order to form words or sentences. Is that right?
Yeah. And they also used in the further experiments the sort of random event generators, which are often used in quantum studies to represent basically they produce random. In this example, it was yes or no. Basically, this machine or program would produce either yes or no, and then they would ask it questions. And the idea is that if a spirit wanted to communicate, it would affect this program that should be random to say either yes or no. And they could see at the end if statistically, you know, it didn't turn out to be what you would expect by chance, then there's an indication that a spirit could be affecting that machine to give a yes or no answer to appropriate to the question.
And these EVPs, electronic voice phenomenon, normally EVPs are recorded onto some sort of a cassette or audio recorder and played back, but these are happening in real time, from what I understand. And Dr. Baruch had an assistant with him. And let's just, if I could backtrack a little bit and get you to reiterate what the assistant claimed she heard or he heard. She recognized a voice.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that happened during the experiments, they heard a voice say, "Tell Peter." And this was actually, they listened to the recordings after and heard that voice, "Tell Peter." And one of the assistants said that that voice sounded like a deceased woman she knows, who, this woman, her husband's name is Peter.
And for Dr. Baruch, what was his takeaway from this? Did he have any theories as to what may have been causing these EVPs?
Yeah, you know, he said that there are three possibilities. Either it's nothing, it's just the people listening to it sort of, you know, hearing maybe what they want to hear or making, you know, words out of random noises. Or it could actually be spirits trying to communicate. And actually, he brought up a third possibility that was really interesting, that the people conducting the experiment, that their minds are affecting the electronic device. And actually, studies have been done at Princeton University basically showing that the human mind can affect an electronic device.
The human mind can affect an electronic device subconsciously. I mean, which is almost as fascinating a concept as spirit voices.
Exactly. And the way they conducted those experiments, it was, again, with the random event generator, like the one used by Dr. Baruch, where, you know, there are two possibilities, and this machine is made to randomly spit them out in whatever order. So, you know, you'd expect a certain probability. And basically, the people in the experiment, they would think that they want the random event generator to produce one of the events more so than the other. And they found that, you know, over the course of many, many experiments, that, you know, it actually showed that this machine was affected to produce that event over the other one. And they found cumulatively over years of study that it was a 1 in a trillion chance that that would have happened without the human mind physically affecting the machines.
1 in a trillion. My word. Mm-hmm. Are you good to take some calls, Tara? Because we've touched a nerve here. People are lined up wanting to talk about this phenomenon.
Yeah, sure. Sounds
all
good.
Right, let's go to the wild card line and say hi to Nick in Garden City, New York. Nick, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Thank you very much, sir. Richard, Tara, it's really great to speak to the both of you. Tara, my question for you is, and perhaps it might seem a little silly, but has there been any attempt to try to trace the phone call, to try to actually call this spirit back in some way, shape, or form? I'd be curious to know if there's any idea or attempt on that.
Well, we're not actually talking about a telephone call in this particular set of experiments, correct, Tara? We're talking about this radio device.
Yeah, I mean, through my reading, I have read about the telephone call, so I could answer that.
Please.
So from what I understand, I mean, in these instances, you know, it happens so randomly, you know, that's why they tried to replicate this in a lab in a controlled experiment, because when you get a phone call from the dead, when these people anecdotally have experienced this, they don't necessarily have the presence of mind to investigate it, you know? And I guess I read one example where a woman got a phone call supposedly from her dead father, who basically said, you know, "I'm okay, I'm with friends," and then the line, it faded out. And she did trace the call. She got the phone company or whatever to trace it, and it came back to her own number. So, I mean, just anecdotally, that's that's what I've read.
Right.
Again, you know, people may not have the presence of mind when this happens to follow up on it, but
understandably, yeah, understandably. Right. Yeah. I mentioned earlier, I've done a number of shows on this phenomenon, and people will call in and talk about having received, or a loved one having received, a call, possibly from the other side, and they'll look at the call display, and it's just a bunch of gobbledygook, no recognizable numbers or even symbols, things like that. Nick, thanks for the call in Garden City, and we'll go west of the Rockies and say hi to Ann in the Tri-Cities in Washington. Hi, Ann.
Again, you know, people may not.
Hello, Ann. Are you there? Ann has her radio on, so get Ann to turn her radio off and try once again. Ann, are you there? West of the Rockies. Hello, Ann. Okay, let's go to the first-time caller line, and we'll say hello to Joe in La Puente, California. Hello, Joe.
How you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, I just want to tell you that I had an experience. I was about 17 years old, and this friend of our family had given me a ride to work. And when I got off the motorcycle, he looked at me and he told me, he says, tell my wife, tell her goodbye. And I couldn't understand why. And then the next day he committed suicide. And a couple years later, my sister got a phone call from the person that committed suicide. And anyway, she called us up and said the fellow called me and told my wife now that he's okay and that he was sorry that he committed suicide.
Wow. And Joe, your sister was what relation to this individual?
No, she didn't even really know him.
She didn't know
my
him.
My wife now that I'm with, they dated for a while, those two guys, this guy, Robbie, and my wife were dating back before I met her.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, they broke up and I started dating my wife. Anyways, and he actually committed suicide, but a couple of years later he called my sister, and I guess it, God works in mysterious ways. I don't know, and he relayed the message to my sister to get to us.
I appreciate the call, Joe. Thank you for that. That's a remarkable story. Let's try Ann again, west of the Rockies in Tri-Cities, Washington. Is she still there?
Yeah, hi there.
Hi, Ann. Welcome. You made it.
Yeah, I made it back, yeah. I have a story if you want to hear about my boyfriend. We were really, really close, but then he died in a car accident in New York, and I'm from Seattle. But then I moved to Tri-Cities, but this happened a few years ago. And then I broke up with him and everything, and I had a new boyfriend, and he did not have my phone number or anything, but all of a sudden, when he died, my sister called my house, and I was on the recording, like, this is me, I live here, this is residence.
Your outgoing voicemail message, right?
Yeah. And then,
right.
And then after the message, he was on there, my sister said. He just came on and started saying, oh, yeah, this is me, Jimmy, and hanging out in this motel room and just having a great old time. And this is after he died.
And you heard the recording? You heard the recording?
My sister did.
And you didn't hear it?
My sister called my house and heard that. And she called me up right away. And she said, did you know that Jimmy just called? I said, how could he? He didn't have my phone number.
Well, more importantly, he didn't have your phone number, but more importantly, he's no longer with us.
Yeah, he was gone. Yeah, and it's like he called on the telephone wire. Why?
Did you personally hear the recording, Ann?
Did you personally hear
the recording?
She heard it and told me.
No. Okay. Well, I would have been curious to want to hear it for myself. Anyway, great story.
Wait, I couldn't have heard it, though, because it wasn't recorded. She just heard it at
the time. It wasn't recorded. She just heard it.
No, I don't think it was. She just happened to hear it. It was on the end of my recording, which she called my house.
I gotcha. Which
couldn't happen.
No, it shouldn't. Let me ask you, Tara, anecdotally, what has your experience been that people are able or not able to record these voices? If someone calls from the other side, has anyone had any success purportedly in actually capturing one of these voices on tape?
I haven't heard of, cases where it's happened sort of randomly like that, where, I've only heard about basically people who are intentionally trying to contact the dead in these means. I mean, it might have happened, but I haven't heard about it.
All right, let's say hi to Ed on the east of the Rockies line. He's in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Hello, Ed.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. The question I have is when a week after my mother passed away, my sister and myself, who we live separately, I had signs about from my mother. They were obviously not phone calls. But I talked to my sister about a month later in a get-together, and she said, I can't believe I had a phone call. Her name is Mary Lou, and she picked up the phone, and was my mother's voice, and certainly a daughter. 40-year-old daughter knows her mother's voice, and she said, Mary Lou. And it freaked my sister out. She didn't know what was going on. She hung up. And I was just wondering how this affects things in the long scheme of things when if there's such a thing as the poor deceased being being kind of put down a little bit, or
Not sure what you mean, Ed. I mean, I'm not sure what you mean by how this affects things. Do you mean for the person who's deceased?
Well, I mean, there's such a thing as you're being contacted, but you're rejecting them.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. Well, I don't know, Tara, how you would respond to that, but
I guess, again, anecdotally, I've kind of heard, there might be multiple opportunities. There's stories of people being called repeatedly over a certain period of time, maybe every night and hearing this person. I don't know. I guess it's a natural reaction to be startled and kind of hang up when you hear somebody that you shouldn't really be hearing on the phone. And, some of the phone calls that I have apparently been assured is, hi, Mom, is that you? Or just a few words, and then it fades out. So, yeah, I'm not really sure, but I mean, it's a pretty natural reaction, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Ed, I hope that answers your question. And so, I guess the takeaway is that if they rang once, they perhaps will ring again. I'm fascinated that this study was actually published in a peer-reviewed journal, and a scientific journal, and did you have any opportunity to speak to Dr. Baruch as to his motivation? Did he have an experience? Why did he decide to pursue this study?
Yeah, I've had some communication with him, and I've also read a little bit of his book. He has had sort of paranormal experiences. I haven't read in depth about them or talked to him in depth about them, but basically, dreams that have sort of predicted future events and things like this. And, he's had students in his classes tell him stories about, for example, he had this one crazy story about this girl who supposedly had a ghost communicate to her through the computer and write things on the screen. And so he's encountered these stories and had enough encounters with them that he sees a very real possibility for it. And as far as, not being published in peer-reviewed journals, he felt that there was sort of this file drawer effect sometimes where people might pick up these studies a little bit but never end up publishing their results or trying to publish them. So even though his first study is titled Failure to Replicate, he decided to publish it anyway so that it's at least on the books.
God bless him for having the courage to delve into this area where few other scientists would fear to tread. Tara McIsaac, I've enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
the Epoch Times. All right, when we come back, rock and roll investigator R. Gary Patterson will delve into the rock and roll subculture, Jimi Hendrix, John Lennon, Otis Redding, and much more. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett.